The condition of affairs in Poland was peculiar. Unlike its three neighbours, Prussia, Russia, and the Austro-Hungarian monarchy of the Habsburgs, Poland hadn't developed a grand monarchy. Its system of government may be best described as republican, with a king, an elected life president. Each king was separately elected. It was in fact rather more republican than Britain, but its republicanism was more aristocratic in form. Poland had little trade and few manufactures. She was agricultural, and still with great areas of grazing, forest, and waste. She was a poor country, and her landowners were poor aristocrats. The mass of her population was a downtrodden and savagely ignorant peasantry, and she also harbored great masses of very poor Jews. She had remained Catholic. She was, so to speak, a poor Catholic inland Britain, entirely surrounded by enemies instead of by the sea. She had no definite boundaries at all, neither sea nor mountain, and it added to her misfortunes that some of her elected kings had been brilliant and aggressive rulers. Eastward, her power extended weakly into regions inhabited almost entirely by Russians. Westward, she overlapped a German subject population. Because she had no great trade, she had no great towns to compare with those of Western Europe, and no vigorous universities to hold her mind together. Her noble class lived on their estates without much intellectual intercourse. They were patriotic, they had an aristocratic sense of freedom, which was entirely compatible with a systematic impoverishment of their serfs. But their patriotism and freedom were incapable of effective cooperation. While warfare was a matter of levies of men and horses, Poland was a comparatively strong power, but it was quite unable to keep pace with the development of military art that was making standing forces of professional soldiers the necessary weapon in warfare. Yet, divided and disabled as she was, she could yet count some notable victories to her credit. The last Turkish attack upon Vienna in 1683 was defeated by the Polish cavalry under King John Sobieski, King John III. This same Sobieski, before he was elected king, had been in the pay of Louis XIV and had also fought for the Swedes against his native country. Needless to say, this weak aristocratic republic, with its recurrent royal elections, invited aggression from all three of its neighbors. Foreign money and every sort of exterior interference came into the country at each election, and like the Greeks of old, every disgruntled Polish patriot flew off to some foreign enemy to wreak his indignation upon his ungrateful country. Even when the King of Poland was elected, he had very little power because of the mutual jealousy of the nobles. Like the English peers, they preferred a foreigner, and for much the same reason, because he had no roots of power in the land. But unlike the British, their own government hadn't the solidarity which the periodic assembling of Parliament in London, the coming up to town, gave the British peers. In London there was society, a continuous intermingling of influential persons and ideas. Poland had no London, and no society, so practically Poland had no central government at all. The King of Poland couldn't make war nor peace, levy a tax nor alter the law without the consent of the Diet, and any single member of the Diet had the power of putting a veto upon any proposal before it. He had merely to rise and say, "I disapprove," and the matter dropped. He could even carry his free veto, his liberum veto, further. He could object to the assembly of the Diet, and the Diet was thereby dissolved. Poland wasn't simply a crowned aristocratic republic like the British. It was a paralyzed crowned aristocratic republic. To Frederick the Great, the existence of Poland was particularly provocative because of the way in which an arm of Poland reached out to the Baltic at Danzig and separated his ancestral dominions in East Prussia from his territories within the empire. It was he who incited Catherine II of Russia and Maria Theresa of Austria, whose respect he had earned by depriving her of Silesia, to a joint attack upon Poland. Let four maps of Poland tell the tale. After this first outrage of 1772, Poland underwent a great change of heart. Poland was indeed born as a nation on the eve of her dissolution. There was a hasty but very considerable development of education, literature, and art. Historians and poets sprang up, and the impossible constitution that had made Poland impotent was swept aside. The free veto was abolished. The crown was made hereditary to save Poland from the foreign intrigues that attended every election, and a parliament in imitation of the British was set up. There were, however, lovers of the old order in Poland who resented these necessary changes, and these obstructives were naturally supported by Prussia and Russia, who wanted no Polish revival. Came the second partition, and, after a fierce patriotic struggle that began in the region annexed by Prussia and found a leader and national hero in Kościuszko, the final obliteration of Poland from the map. So, for a time, ended this parliamentary threat to grand monarchy in Eastern Europe. But the patriotism of the Poles grew stronger and clearer with suppression. For 120 years, Poland struggled like a submerged creature beneath the political and military net that held her down. She rose again in 1918, at the end of the Great War. 8. We've given some account of the ascendancy of France in Europe, the swift decay of the sappy growth of Spanish power, and its separation from Austria, and the rise of Prussia. So far as Portugal, Spain, France, Britain, and Holland were concerned, their competition for ascendancy in Europe was extended and complicated by a struggle for dominion overseas. The discovery of the huge continent of America, thinly inhabited, undeveloped, and admirably adapted for European settlement and exploitation, the simultaneous discovery of great areas of unworked countries south of the torrid equatorial regions of Africa that had hitherto limited European knowledge, and the gradual realization of vast island regions in the eastern seas as yet untouched by Western civilization, was a presentation of opportunity to mankind unprecedented in all history. It was as if the peoples of Europe had come into some splendid legacy. Their world had suddenly quadrupled. There was more than enough for all. They had only to take these lands and continue to do well by them, and their crowded poverty would vanish like a dream. And they received this glorious legacy like ill-bred heirs. It meant no more to them than a fresh occasion for atrocious disputes. But what community of human beings has ever yet preferred creation to conspiracy? What nation in all our story has ever worked with another, when, at any cost to itself, it could contrive to do that other an injury? The powers of Europe began by a frantic claiming of the new realms. They went on to exhausting conflicts. Spain, who claimed first and most, and who was for a time a mistress of two-thirds of America, made no better use of her possession than to bleed herself nearly to death therein. We've told how the papacy, in its last assertion of world dominion, instead of maintaining the common duty of all Christendom to make a great common civilization in the new lands, divided the American continent between Spain and Portugal. This naturally roused the hostility of the excluded nations. The seamen of England showed no respect for either claim, and set themselves particularly against the Spanish. The Swedes turned their Protestantism to a similar account. The Hollanders, as soon as they'd shaken off their Spanish masters, also set their sails westward to flout the Pope and share in the good things of the New World. His Most Catholic Majesty of France hesitated as little as any Protestant. All these powers were soon busy staking out claims in North America and the West Indies.